Welcome to Life in Debt, your practical debt education program. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, an award-winning, listener-supported, open-source, grassroots, and partially solar-powered community radio station broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield. Please note that these presentations are provided as a public service for general information purposes only, and are not intended to be legal opinions, legal advice, or complete discussions of any legal issues. Remember, every individual's factual situation is different, and you should seek independent legal advice from an attorney familiar with the laws of your state or locality regarding specific information. The name of this show is Life and Debt, and it is a weekly half-hour educational show looking at all types of issues related to debt as it influences your life. The show provides practical, general knowledge about what to look for regarding debt, what are its traps and pitfalls, and what to do to be an educated debtor. Please get some notebook paper and pen so you can take notes during the show. We always look at some debt-related news and facts for the week to start off the show. From a work called End of the American Dream, 14 Bad Signs for the North American Economy. Our world has changed, and most do not realize it. Money, the almighty purveyor of our well-being, has absolutely no value unless someone says it does. It used to be tied to gold, a tangible physical element. You could not print more money unless you had gold to back it. However, in 1971, the U.S. abolished the gold standard and said the money was tied to the GDP, and today the value of money is tied to debt. Banks have been able for years to operate under the fiat money system, which may or may not have any reserves tied to it. So banks have been able to dictate the value of our money, not governments. Our governments borrow money from banks at interest. Then there is the invention of the credit rating organization to see whose debt is more worthy than others. However, none of this has any bearing on the world. It does not reflect a person's worth or value in society. However, we are tied to the system for our very existence, but it does not create anything other than debt. One cannot get money unless they owe money. Example, you work to earn money and you are paid by your employer, and your employer borrows money from the bank to pay your salary. The bank invests the money your company borrows, however, to keep its assets up. It borrows from another bank,
which can then invest
that money that it lends to the other bank, and on and on and on. The bank monopoly has the world entrenched in a system that only feeds the top. Capitalism is a misnomer, as the capital that is needed really never existed before. The following are 14 pieces of bad news for the U.S. economy. And again, this is according to the End of the American Dream. Number one, according to RealtyTrack, foreclosure filings were reported on 367,056 properties in the month of March 2010. This represented an increase of almost 19% from February, and it was also an increase of nearly 8% from March in 2009. In fact, the number for March 2010 was the highest monthly total since RealtyTrack began issuing its report in January of 2005. And yet, things are expected to get even worse for the housing market. RealtyTrack projects that there will be 4.5 million home foreclosures before the end of 2010. If you figure that there are approximately 4 people per household, that is another 18 million people that will be forced out of their homes by the end of the year. And number three, interest rates have already gone up, and most experts forecast that they will continue to increase throughout the rest of 2010 and into 2011. This is going to make existing adjustable mortgages more expensive, and this will also make it even harder for homebuyers to purchase a home. Needless to say, this is likely to put significant downward pressure on housing prices. Number four, it turns out that the much-celebrated foreclosure assistance program introduced by Barack Obama is helping very, very few mortgage holders, and the default rates for those who have managed to receive help are still very high. From all appearances, it seems as though the U.S. government is unable to do very much at all to turn around the real estate market. Number five, the unemployment crisis continues to grow worse. The number of unemployed Americans per job opening has started to increase again, hitting 5.5 in February. There just are not nearly enough jobs for everyone, and this is creating a great deal of despair among unemployed workers. Many of those who do manage to find work have been only able to obtain part-time employment. Gallup's underemployment measure hit 20% on March 15th. This was up from 19.7% 2 weeks earlier and 19.5% at the start of the year. This is not a good trend. Number six, the International Monetary Fund is forecasting that unemployment will remain high for at least two more years. Unfortunately, IMF forecasts tend to be chillingly accurate, so those Americans hoping for an employment boom in the coming months are likely to be quite disappointed. Number seven, even with the economy struggling and so many out of work, the price of gasoline continues to skyrocket. It is almost as if the 1970s have struck again, and we are back in the days of the misery index. In some areas of the United States, people are already paying as much as $3.50 for a gallon of gasoline, and many experts are predicting that gasoline could hit $4 a gallon by the end of 2010. Number eight, and healthcare costs show no sign of slowing down either. Even the Los Angeles Times, which is radically pro-Obama, is admitting that the new health care law will not prevent health care premiums from continuing to increase dramatically. Number nine, well, it turns out that the new health care bill is not good for physician-owned hospitals either. According to the executive director of Physicians Hospitals of America, more than 60 doctor-owned hospitals across the United States that were in the development stage will now be canceled. Why will they be canceled? Apparently, the new law singles out doctor-owned hospitals, making new doctor-owned projects ineligible to receive payments for Medicare and Medicaid patients. Number 10, not only that, but soon the United States will be facing a critical shortage of physicians. The U.S. healthcare system was already facing a shortage of approximately $150,000 in the next decade or so. But according to this article, healthcare changes in the new bill will result in growth by several hundred thousand more. Number 11, cities and states across America are facing unprecedented financial pressure. For example, many analysts believe that the city of Los Angeles is on the verge of bankruptcy. Of course, the entire state of California is a financial wasteland at this point, so this is not much of a surprise. Number 12, several prominent economic analysts are now declaring the risk that the government of Japan will go bankrupt, and that is very real. If Japan does financially implode, that will have major implications for the United States, as Japan is one of our biggest and most important trading partners. Number 13, the world's five biggest AAA-rated countries, including the United States, are all at risk of soaring debt costs and will have to implement austerity plans that threaten social cohesion, according to a report on sovereign debt by Moody's. To get an idea of how popular austerity plans are, we can look to what has happened in Greece lately, where there are riots. And last, 14. Trillions have been pumped into the U.S. economy over the last couple of years, and officially, all we have to show for it is about 2% growth. Plus, we have an exploding national debt that our children and grandchildren will never, ever be able to pay off. The U.S. government continues to spend money like it is water, and yet the U.S. economy continues to be trapped in a death spiral. The reality is that we have created an economic nightmare from which there is no escape, and it is going to take every ounce of government spending and intervention just to keep the economy functioning somewhat normally. All of this is from End of the American Dream. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and this program is Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. Now I'd like to move ahead to something that has solutions attached to it, which is The Two-Income Trap, Why Middle-Class Parents Are Going Broke, by Professor Elizabeth Warren of Harvard and Amelia Warren-Tiagi, her daughter. And I will start with a credit because the thoughts, ideas, and examples used in this program are directly from or based on the work, theories, and books of Professor Elizabeth Warren and her daughter, Amelia Warren Tyagi, who are two of America's leading champions for debtors. I highly recommend their books, All Your Worth and The Two Income Trap. You can also revisit all of the Life and Debt shows, which have been produced over the last several years, at www.kruufm.com. Go into archives and look under Life and Debt, and you can get a real education on what has been happening in our economy and ways to deal with your personal debt, both past and present. Now, last week, I ended up with further discussion of the single mom and the single dad in the wake of a divorce. Over the last generation, there has been a lot of emphasis on getting fathers to pay child support as a solution to the debt dilemma. Professor Warren points out that the illusion that dads can pay enough to stabilize the broken family is born partly of hope and partly of despair. If dad can't pay more, how does the single mother ever escape the two-income trap? And for that matter, how does the divorced father break free? They do it the same way the dual-income family does. The predicament of divorced mothers has worsened, not because divorce itself is any harder, but because couples today are in worse shape before they split up. Solutions that improve the financial footing of a married couple will help divorcing parents by putting them in a stronger position as they embark on their newly separated lives. So, for example, what the professor points out is if decent public schools were made available to all children, regardless of the child's zip code, then the bidding wars for suburban housing would let up and the newly single mother could start off divorced life with a more modest mortgage. She also might be less reluctant to give up the family home and move into a cheaper house if a school choice policy ensured that she wouldn't be forced to transfer the kids to an unfamiliar and often inferior public school. Similarly, if public-funded preschool were made available to all children, a single mother with young children would have some more leeway in her budget. And in prior shows, I talked about these issues in great detail. The availability of decent public schools, not by just proximity, and publicly funded preschools. So that's one way to deal with the problem. Another way is policies that encourage personal savings and discourage debt, which were also discussed in the past. This would help both spouses survive the economic aftermath of divorce. If a woman started her divorced life with no credit card debt and some money in the bank, she would have a better chance of holding on to her house and staying out of the bankruptcy courts. Likewise, if a father left his marriage on more secure financial footing, he would stand a better chance of making his child support payments and keeping himself and his ex-wife out of bankruptcy. In addition, policies that expand health insurance and disability coverage would particularly benefit single parents because they are most vulnerable when disaster strikes. Professor Warren then asks if there are any policies that should single out the single mother, and she says there might be one. Universal publicly funded daycare might have unintended financial consequences, some of which would be particularly negative for the traditional single breadwinner two-parent family. But the government could play another role in taking care of youngsters, free or subsidized childcare for children of single parents. This would give the newly single mother an immediate, much-needed financial leg up, improving her chances of competing in a two-income world. And it would do so without increasing the pressure on two-parent families to send both adults to work. So Professor Warren concludes that during the past generation, the single mother has come into her own politically. Nearly 10 million strong, these women are no longer shunned by politicians and religious leaders. They star in sitcoms, they are featured in congressional debates, and they help swing elections. but their economic fortunes or misfortunes are treated as something that begin the day their marriages end. Politicians build up political capital by loudly proclaiming their support for these women, while their ex-husbands either disappear from the story or are vilified as deadbeats who don't care about their children. But in Professor Warren's view, all that noise just diverts attention from any meaningful changes that could actually improve the lot of middle-class mothers and fathers. Current views of the economics of divorce accomplish little more than stoking a tired old battle between the sexes. The laws have been changed, and child support orders, while not perfect, are now reasonably well enforced for millions of middle-class families. It's time for a fresh approach to improving the circumstances of all middle-class parents, married and single alike.
Now, Professor Warren tells a story that has historical perspective and interest to it, considering what has happened since. And it also shows what politics is all about. In May of 1998, First Lady Hillary Clinton was the star attraction at a Boston fundraiser for candidates who supported women's issues. The lineup was impressive. She stood shoulder to shoulder with half a dozen congresswomen, including Nancy Pelosi and Sheila Jackson Lee, arguably among the most powerful female politicians in America at that time. Mrs. Clinton was in her element, vibrant and hard-hitting, in front of an almost all-woman audience that applauded her every sentence. Her speech was part policy, federal subsidies for daycare and access to health insurance, and part pep rally, help send more Democrats to Congress. She swept out of the ballroom as the crowd jumped to their feet to cheer her on. Elizabeth Warren stood waiting in the darkened hallway in a service entrance. She had been invited to meet with Mrs. Clinton, and there she stood, not knowing a single person either in the ballroom or among the entourage that trailed along with Mrs. Clinton. She listened as young women, presumably Mrs. Clinton's aides, chatted quietly about who were the major players in the room and whether that neon red jacket made one of the congresswomen look too patsy. Behind Professor Warren, two beefy men in overcoats stood silently, continuously scanning in all directions. Mrs. Clinton thrust her hand forward. "You must be Professor Warren," she said. "I read your op-ed in the New York Times about women and bankruptcy, and I want to talk with you." Now, a few weeks earlier, Professor Warren had written a column that sharply criticized a bill making its way through Congress that proposed to undercut bankruptcy protections for middle-class families in financial trouble. But before she could respond, Mrs. Clinton snapped her head sharply to the side and called to no one in particular, "Where's the lunch? I'm hungry." They were ushered to a small office with cracked leather chairs, carefully set out with lunch for the First Lady, half a hamburger, French fries, and Diet Coke, and an iced tea for Professor Warren. The small army of aides and security agents were left behind in the hallway. There were the two of them in that tiny room. If you're just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and this program is Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. And this is a story from Professor Warren about her meeting with the First Lady, Hillary Clinton, in 1998. So the setting is that they're having a meeting in a small room. And Professor Warren continues, "Before she had taken a single bite of her hamburger, Mrs. Clinton tore into the business at hand. I have two questions for you. How are women affected by the bankruptcy laws? And how did a woman get to be a chaired professor at Harvard Law School?" For the next 25 minutes, Professor Warren pounded Mrs. Clinton with graphs, charts, and projections. She ate fast and asked questions even faster, that is, Mrs. Clinton. Professor Warren had taught bankruptcy law to thousands of students, some of them among the brightest in the country, but she said she never saw one like Mrs. Clinton, impatient, lightning quick, and interested in all the nuances. In just half an hour, she went from knowing almost nothing about the bankruptcy system to grasping the
counterintuitive twist that single mothers were helped when their ex-husbands filed bankruptcy because these men could discharge credit card debts and use the money to catch up on their child support. Professor Warren explained to Mrs. Clinton how the pending bankruptcy bill would effectively dismantle bankruptcy protections for families, forcing single mothers to compete with legions of credit card bill collectors for an ex-husband's income, and making it more difficult for families to hold on to their homes. At the end of their discussion, Mrs. Clinton stood up and said, "Well, I'm convinced. It is our job to stop that awful bill. You help me, and I'll help you." Then they talked university politics for a bit, then walked outside, and as they stepped through the door, Mrs. Clinton grabbed Professor Warren by the shoulder, turned her for an obligatory photograph, shook hands with her, and headed off with her own people. Mrs. Clinton's newfound opposition to the bankruptcy bill surprised Professor Warren. Given her legal training and her devotion to women's causes, Professor Warren expected Mrs. Clinton to grasp the importance of the issue, but President Clinton's staff had been quietly supporting the bankruptcy bill for several months. Bill Clinton wanted to show that he and other new Democrats could play ball with business interests, and the major banks were lobbying hard for changes in the bankruptcy law. Professor Warren had expected that it would take a lot more than 30 minutes to convince Hillary Clinton to depart from the position widely rumored to be supported by her husband. But Mrs. Clinton stayed firm in her fight against that awful bill. She was convinced that the bill was unfair to women and children, and she intended to stand by her principles, even if it cost some Democratic Party candidates campaign contributions. Over the ensuing months, she was true to her word. With her strong support, the Democrats slowed the bill's passage through Congress. When Congress finally passed the bill in October of 2000, President Clinton vetoed it. The following summer, an aide explained to Professor Warren the abrupt about-face. "A couple of days after Mrs. Clinton met with you, we changed sides on the bankruptcy bill so fast that you could see skid marks in the hallway of the White House." Thanks to Mrs. Clinton, families still had one financial refuge left, at least for the moment. Now remember, this is back at the turn of the century. But the story didn't end there. The banking lobbyists were persistent. President Clinton was on his way out, and credit card giant MBNA emerged as the single biggest contributors to President Bush's campaign. In the spring of 2001, the bankruptcy bill was reintroduced in the Senate, essentially unchanged from the version President Clinton
had vetoed the previous year.
Now, this time, freshman Senator Hillary Clinton voted in favor of the bill. Had the bill been transformed to get rid of all those awful provisions that had so convinced First Lady Hillary Clinton? No, it hadn't. The bill was essentially the same, but Hillary Rodham Clinton was not. As First Lady, Mrs. Clinton had been persuaded that the bill was bad for families, and she was willing to fight for her beliefs. Her husband was a lame duck at the time he vetoed the bill. He could afford to forego future campaign contributions. As New York's newest senator, however, it seemed that Hillary Clinton could not afford such a principled position. Campaigns cost money, and that money wasn't coming from families in financial trouble. Senator Clinton received $140,000 in campaign contributions from the banking industry executives in a single year, making her one of the two top recipients in the Senate. Big banks were now part of Senator Clinton's constituency. She wanted their support, and they wanted hers, including a vote in favor of that awful bill. And the rest is history now. That bill took a few more times through Congress, but in 2005, that awful bill became the law.
This is one clear example of how high-quality, intelligent, very good people can get highly influenced by the need for lobbying funds in politics. And of course, how that influences the outcome of legislation that has affected middle-class people tremendously, like the bankruptcy law. So Professor Warren continues in this saga. the story of how millions of seemingly ordinary middle-class families found themselves falling off a financial cliff. Just at the time when parents got caught in a vicious bidding war for middle-class housing, which we discussed in the past, just as the cost of college tuition and health insurance shot into the stratosphere, just as layoffs increased and the divorce rate jumped, a new player appeared on the scene. That is, a new deregulated lending industry emerged, eager to lend a few bucks whenever the family came up short. Now, Professor Warren's talking about this just as it is emerging and not today, where we're seeing the devastating aftermath of what was created. But back then, at the turn of the century, pick up any newspaper and there was a story about America's most widespread addiction, which was the insatiable hunger for debt. Every year for the past decade up to 2002, mortgage debt had set a new record. Equity home loans grew even faster, increasing by over 150% in just 4 years, and no one would dare leave home without a fistful of those little plastic cards. Now, this is going up to 2002, 2003, and that actually skyrocketed even more over the next 5 years. Now, Professor Warren says that the news media rarely gave any explanation for why all that debt piled up, leaving the reader to infer that the debt explosion is some sort of inevitable byproduct of today's moral and economic climate. But let's get real. Americans didn't wake up one morning and decide en masse that they needed stuff so much that they'd be delighted to take on a big fat second mortgage and they'd be thrilled to skip a credit card payment or two, as the headlines then implied and still continue to imply. Nor was there a sudden national conspiracy of people who buy credit cards and then max them out, as at least one prominent professor of finance claimed. Those mountains of debt were made possible by one very important change that largely went unnoticed in all the discussions about Americans in debt. A seemingly small modification in the laws of consumer finance, a tiny change that transformed centuries of family economics in an instant. Just a generation ago, the American family simply couldn't get into the kind of financial hole that has become so familiar today. And now we're speaking today, meaning the last decade. The reason was straightforward. A middle-class family couldn't borrow very much money in the past. High-limit, all-purpose credit cards did not exist for those with average means. There were no mortgages available for 125% of the home's value, and no offers in the Daily Mail for second and third home equity loans. There were no payday lenders, no live checks, and no instant money, and certainly no offers to consolidate all that debt by moving it from one credit card to another. A generation ago, a family that wanted to borrow money had only a handful of options. Instead of running up debt anonymously, a prospective borrower was forced to meet a stern-looking banker face-to-face. Families were asked to produce past tax returns and pay stubs, credit references, and projected budgets that showed how they planned to repay the money. If they wanted to take out a mortgage for a new home, they were typically required to come up with a 20% down payment from their own savings. If they wanted money for other purposes, they were required to give a detailed account of their spending plans, and the bank had a fairly narrow set of answers it wanted to get. Building an extra room on the house, buying a new car, sending the twins off to college. Some retailers offered credit to move their merchandise, but cash loans and lines of credit for making ends meet until John finds a new job, or putting groceries on the table until the child support check begin, were not in the lending lexicon. And we will continue this analysis next week. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you have been listening to Life and Debt, your debt education program. If you have any questions or comments, call the station at 641-209-1083, or you can email me at lifeanddebt@gmail.com. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice in Fairfield, Iowa.
May you enjoy and have a healthy and prosperous debt manageable life.